Welcome to Hub Headlines. Today's program features the best commentary and analysis published in the Hub for March 27th. Up first is Joe McKinnon writing on why climate policy should just be about climate.
It was recently announced that the 29th Conference of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, COP29, will be held in Baku, Azerbaijan later this year. Following COP27 in Egypt and COP28 in the United Arab Emirates, it represents the third consecutive climate change conference hosted by an authoritarian oil and gas-producing state. One could point out the obvious hypocrisy on the part of the global climate establishment, but that seems almost too easy. Perhaps the more interesting question is why these countries want to host the conferences in the first place. It's not because they're motivated by a deep will for global betterment. It's because they understand that today's economics, particularly in energy and natural resources, is heavily shaped by climate policy. Yet the role of economics in climate change action has been somewhat subordinated here in the West in favor of a theme of climate justice. We see, for instance, climate advocates in Western countries engaging in demonstrations and displays of rebellion that historically would have been used to protest major human rights issues. In Canada, thoughtful climate action seems to be impossible without the inclusion of social justice, including issues of race, gender, and sexuality. Last year, a private member's bill, Bill C-226, which calls for a national strategy to assess, prevent and address environmental racism, and to advance environmental justice, passed third reading in the House of Commons. On the international front, the International Institute of Environment and Development has championed the goal of queering climate justice, including how climate justice has drawn from and built on ideologies from different right-based movements, including civil rights, queer rights, and women's rights. We can also see this trend in Western business and financial institutions as the environmental, social, and governance, or ESG, movement promotes investments that are valued based on their environmental and social effects. Questions about profitability or broader economic value can be subordinated to social justice or climate considerations. The net result is that a lot of contemporary climate policy seems to be driven more by emotion than hard-headed thinking, including cost-benefit analysis, the relative costs of different approaches, and a lot of deficit-financed spending by Western governments. These actions may lower emissions, but at tremendous economic costs. Countries like Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, and Azerbaijan are thinking about climate change quite differently. They understand that global action on climate change is influencing real economic change. These developments are now manifesting themselves, for instance, in global commodity markets and future investment strategies. These countries may not be motivated by climate action per se, but even a strictly economic lens requires that they take note of these trends. Political tools like the COP meetings are a means for them to influence these developments. By hosting these climate meetings, countries like Azerbaijan nudge global climate policy in a more pragmatic position regarding hydrocarbons and green financing. They can also leverage political capital and an insider position to remain key stakeholders in a rapidly changing global economy, including positioning themselves as financiers of the energy transition. Canada and other Western countries would be well served by shifting their own thinking on climate change to a more hard-headed approach. Policymakers cannot forget that the greatest reductions in carbon emissions have come from technological shifts driven by market forces, not through virtue signaling or social activism. In the United States, increased fracking led natural gas to displace higher-emitting coal, which has caused the largest decline in carbon dioxide equivalent emissions of any country over the last 15 years. From 2005 to 2021, Ontario similarly saw the greatest reduction in carbon emissions by any province due to the closure of coal-fired power plants, which was largely replaced by nuclear and a combination of natural gas and non-hydro renewables. Climate progress requires effective cost-benefit analysis that cooperates with natural market mechanisms. Recentering policy development on the economics of climate change is likely to resonate more with the new climate dialogues taking place in countries like Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, and Azerbaijan. This trend has shown us that these nations are ready to come to the table and discuss our energy and climate future, but within a framework that recognizes that these are fundamentally economic questions. It's also likely the best means to achieve climate progress at the lowest cost and in turn maintain public support for the types of changes that we'll need to pursue in the coming years. The West needs to stop conflating climate progress with the trappings of social progressivism and must refocus on how the dismal yet ultimately valuable science can be best integrated into our economic realities.
That was a commentary by Joe McKinnon. He is a public policy professional managing economic regulation in the electricity sector. You can find the full text of his article on our website, thehub.ca.
Hi, Hub Podcast listener. Fun fact to share with you. Well, not really. This year, most major newspapers in Canada will join the CBC and fund the majority of their journalists' salaries through one form of government-coordinated subsidy or another. Here at The Hub, we think this is bad for journalism and bad for news consumers like you. This is why The Hub is not availing itself of these government subsidies. But producing high-quality, independent news and analysis is expensive and time-consuming. This is why we are asking you now to become a Hub subscriber for as little as 25 cents a day. Get all kinds of great benefits, including subscriber-only analysis of the economy and politics, podcast content, and so much more, all with the knowledge that your support makes our independent journalism possible. Join at thehub.ca.
Our second essay is by Heather Exner-Pirro, presenting a defense of natural gas.
Two provincial energy regulator decisions, released quietly in late December, show how climate ambitions are starting to override energy realities in policymaking. The consequences are likely to be felt as energy shortages within the next 3 years. On December 21, the Ontario Energy Board denied Enbridge's proposed capital budget as part of a new rate application, citing concerns about stranded natural gas assets and emboldened by ambitions for the energy transition. The OEB reduced the revenue horizon that Enbridge uses to determine the economic feasibility of new gas connections from 40 years to zero. In effect, this means residential customers would have to absorb the full cost of new gas connections up front instead of over four decades, as is the current practice. Enbridge forecasts the decision will lead to a shortfall in energy supply as early as 2025. The province's energy minister, Todd Smith, objected to the decision immediately, committing to pause and reverse the decision. They have now introduced legislation to do so, saying it would slow or even halt the construction of affordable homes amidst the housing crisis. Meanwhile, on December 22, the British Columbia Utilities Commission rejected FortisBC's application to increase its pipeline capacity in the central and north Okanagan regions. FortisBC had argued the expansion was necessary to accommodate the increase in peak natural gas demand due to a growing population in the region. The BCUC found that FortisBC's proposal did not reflect the commitments made in the province's Clean BC Roadmap and did not consider building step codes that may be adopted by municipalities. Step codes set progressively lower acceptable GHG emission levels for new homes. For its part, FortisBC forecasts the decision would lead to a shortfall in energy supply as early as winter 2026-2027. These decisions make it clear that climate change ambitions have taken a front seat with Canada's energy regulators. This represents a shift beyond the core mandate of an economic regulator, which is to ensure energy costs for consumers are fair and investments by utilities are prudently incurred. The decisions share these flawed assumptions. 1. That climate policy should be accepted as determinative of future energy system design, rather than as aspirational targets. 2. That more risk should be assigned to the possibility of stranded assets than to the threat of energy shortages. 3. That Canada has the ability to generate and deliver the amount of electricity needed to replace natural gas in the timeframes policymakers prefer. And 4. That the natural gas market will erode due to the energy transition, even as we observe increased consumption to meet not only a growing population but new sources of energy demand from data centers, AI, and other drivers. In Canada, as elsewhere, we currently benefit from three major energy systems operating in parallel. A liquid system for fuels like diesel and gasoline, primarily for transportation, a gas system for natural gas, primarily for heating, and a grid for electrons for electricity. Natural gas represents the largest share of this overall mix. Of the nearly 12,000 petajoules consumed by Canadians annually, natural gas represents 37.5%, refined petroleum products 36.9%, and electricity 17.5%, of which 13% is generated by natural gas. While residential and commercial natural gas consumption is highly seasonal, it shows no signs of declining. Statistics Canada data up to 2023 indicate record demand in winter of that year, commensurate with a fast-growing population. Natural gas popularity is linked to its affordability. It is the cheapest source of energy in Canada. Even at 2022 prices, which were higher than the five-year average, and saw natural gas around $5 per gigajoule, it cost the equivalent of $0.018 per kilowatt hours of electricity, or $0.17 per litre of gasoline. To the consumer, affordability is perhaps natural gas' greatest attribute. In Ontario, for example, the list of communities that want natural gas access far outweighs the capital available to connect them all to the system. The provincial Conservatives have been supporting the expansion of the gas pipeline system to serve markets currently reliant on higher-priced energy sources such as propane, heating oil, and electricity. But from an energy security perspective, redundancy and diversity in energy supply are also very important. Calls to electrify everything are not only logistically and economically unrealistic, but highly risky. In Canada, a prolonged grid failure would create emergencies for Canadians in the summer and be catastrophic in the winter. Having separate energy systems provides better security, not only against weather-induced failures, but from physical and cyber attacks as well. Pipelines and electricity grids are both vulnerable due to their ubiquity and strategic importance and form regular targets for adversaries, terrorists, and criminals. In 2022, the U.S. Department of Energy saw attacks on the grid increase by 77%, and in North America, the energy industry was the most common target for cyber attacks. Deliberating moving to an energy system that relies on a single network is reckless. In addition, electrons and molecules play very different roles in our energy system and are not interchangeable. Electricity tends to be more stock-based and oil and natural gas are flow-based. There are advantages and disadvantages to both. Commentators will often argue that energy security would be enhanced by more reliance on long-life assets such as dams, windmills, and solar panels that produce electricity with free inputs of water, wind, and solar energy once the upfront investment is made. Energy from fossil fuels, by contrast, depends on a constant input, or flow, of products. Because oil and natural gas are traded globally, they are susceptible to price volatility and supply shocks. But the benefit of flows is that you can store the product and subsequently ramp it up to meet peaks in demand. Advanced economies generally have months' worth of oil and natural gas in storage. Canada has 950 billion cubic feet of natural gas storage, enough for approximately 63 days of winter demand. On a cold January day, you can ramp up flows of natural gas to meet the surge in heating demands. Electricity, by contrast, is consumed instantly and cannot be built up in advance. As an example, in the severe cold snap that hit Alberta this winter, electricity demand set a new all-time peak record of 12,384 megawatts on January 13. Demand came very close to exceeding what the electricity system was able to supply, prompting an emergency grid alert calling on Albertans to reduce power usage. At the same time, the natural gas system delivered over 110,340 megawatts of energy, or about 9 times as much as electricity. It is impossible to imagine an energy system able to handle peak demand in Canada using only electricity. While BC and Ontario have slightly more favorable climates than Alberta, it is not uncommon for the Okanagan or Ottawa to dip to the minus 30s, and Toronto can see minus 20s. These are life-threatening temperatures. With an addition of 1 million Canadians a year, it is hard to see how our current and planned electricity generation could replace our incremental natural gas needs on a very cold day. Yet that is the situation that regulators in BC and Ontario are engineering. If restricting natural gas supply looks reckless from an affordability and reliability perspective, one must acknowledge that the intentions on the sustainability side are legitimate. Natural gas is cleaner and less carbon-intensive than coal and heating oil, but it still emits carbon dioxide. How do we bridge the need for gas molecules in our energy system with the need to lower emissions? Strategies generally include a combination of carbon capture, hydrogen blending, and renewable natural gas. All of these have tremendous potential and are advancing from the research development phase to commercialization, but they will invariably confer higher costs to consumers. The appetite of Canadians to pay more in energy costs, when given a choice from their utility to purchase lower-emitting sources of energy, is low. While there is an almost perfect overlap between natural gas customers and voters in Canada, their policy preferences when paying utility bills and when lining up at the ballot box have looked very different. Those preferences are about to collide. In Canada, we have been able to take our energy supply for granted. On our current policy trajectory, we will soon lose that luxury.
That was a commentary by Heather Exner-Piro. She is the Director of Energy, Natural Resources and Environment at the McDonald Laurier A. Institute. That's it for today's edition of Hub Headlines. We hope you enjoyed the program. To receive all our best commentary and analysis each morning by email, subscribe to The Hub for as little as 25 cents a day. You can do that right now at thehub.ca. Hub Headlines is produced by Alicia Rao. Thanks for listening.